3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
Highly double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to 3CR Thursday Breakfast, and it's the 14th of August. I cannot believe it's August already, but to make it a little bit sweeter, I am joined in the studio with Leela. Leela, how are you?
Good morning, Inez. It is always nice to come in, but, you know, it's also rough. I think it's getting to that point of my media crisis. Is that, yeah, that's a thing now.
Absolutely
it is. I'm naming.
You know, trend cycles are speeding up. I think midlife crisis should too. every year, annual crisis. Yeah. How have you been this morning? How's your rest been?
You know, up and down, but I am trying to get rest where I can. I think, you know, in our culture, we have a lot of performance of work, and so I'm trying to unlearn that and actually just rest throughout my day mentally and just unlearn the need to always look busy. Winter
definitely.
Is the time to do that as well.
Absolutely. So many reflections, so many realizations. and speaking of, we have a beautiful show with a mix of pre-records, lives, and in-studio interview, which we haven't had in a while. But I'll start us off with what we have on. First up, we have Shauna Moore, who is the head of policy advocacy and government relations at Melbourne City Mission, who joined me yesterday to discuss MCM and Social Ventures Australia, 2025 Victorian Youth Homelessness Snapshot, which paints a really stark picture of the deep and intersecting challenges faced by young people experiencing homelessness in Victoria. None of this is new, but, you know, some of what we spoke about is the data reveals that most young Victorians are losing their homes due to family violence, many before the age of 16. Most are being cut off from school and employment pathways and ending up in emergency systems. And actually, a lot of the people, young people who are losing their homes, were known to Victoria's child protection system, experienced chronic pain, First Nations, rural, regional, LGBTIQA+, and overseas-born backgrounds were all overrepresented. So it was a lot to speak about, but we just wanted to talk about, yeah, there's importance of the snapshot, the coalition, and where to from here.
And then, on Monday, the 4th of August, Hank, a public housing tenant, locked himself to a drill, taking samples for demolition at Flemington Public Housing Estate. Hank successfully delayed works for over 2 hours and was supported by a community picket to save the 44 housing towers scheduled for demolition. Flemington residents have been told they must leave their homes by the end of September. Public housing tenants and advocates are urgently calling on the Victorian government to halt demolition immediately. And you can find out more about how to get involved in one of the most important local fights by visiting link, that is linktr.tree.tree. We'll put it in our show notes. And you can also show your support by signing the petition to save public housing. And after that, we are going to hear a segment from last Monday where Rob from 3CR's Monday Breakfast Show spoke with welfare rights activist Tom Students about the federal court case Chaplin v Secretary. The court ruled that the federal government will need to recalculate over $4 billion worth of debts issued using a method known as income apportionment, which was in use from the early 90s until 2020. In this conversation, Tom Students unpacks the history of income apportionment debt calculations, and its legislative overlaps with robo-debt. And you can hear that whole interview and more from Monday Breakfast by going to 3cr.org.au/Monday-breakfast.
Amazing. And then lastly, we'll be joined by Elijah McDonald, who is a Noongar Pitta Pitta Agamincha tech artist, junior programmer, and Rosie Kalina, who is Wemba Wemba Gunjimara, art and cultural producer from Blacktasia, this continent's first ever Aboriginal mobile game. And they join us in the studio to discuss the making of the game, art, inspiration, the everyday work it takes to make a game by mob for mob, where you restore the bush and defeat the corrupting force of the Merc. And it's set in the black world inspired by country. You definitely don't want to miss this wonderful interview. We have lots of incredible themes today that are important to talk about: youth homelessness, safe public housing, welfare rights, and then, yeah, finish it off with First Nations game design. It's going to be really lovely.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and we'll be right back with our headlines. We'll see you in a sec.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 14th of August. Palestinians and advocacy groups have warned that the Albanese government's plan to recognise Palestinian statehood will be meaningless without decisive action to end Israel's genocide and apartheid. The Jewish Council has called for an immediate end to the federal government's military and economic cooperation with Israel, and the Australian Palestinian Advocacy Network, or APAN, continue to urge sanctions against Israeli leaders accused of war crimes and an arms embargo.
This week in Gaza and the West Bank. Israel's targeted numbers of Palestinians in Gaza have again intensified, with the murder of at least six journalists, including four Al Jazeera staff. Al Jazeera condemned the killings by the Israeli Defense Force as targeted assassinations, aimed at silencing coverage of the genocide. Palestinians are starving amid widespread famine conditions, with a leaked Israeli cabinet transcript revealing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu deliberately chose to starve Gaza's population and break a ceasefire against the advice of his military and intelligence officials. Meanwhile, Israel is reportedly in talks with South Sudan to forcibly relocate Palestinians from Gaza, a move human rights groups warn would constitute ethnic cleansing and violate international law. In the West Bank, a Palestinian man was injured from attacks by Israeli settlers, and Israeli forces arrested 10 Palestinians in raids across Qalqiqa, Nablus and Hebron.
Also this week, in a win for those fighting for the right to protest, the state government has announced a scaling back of proposed anti-protest laws after widespread opposition from human rights groups, unions and community organisations. Plans for a $2,000 fine and an outright ban on face coverings at protests now comes with the caveat that only those refusing police cooperation or those suspected of criminal activity will be targeted. And restrictions on protest devices like chains will apply only when the community safety risks exist. Despite the significant scaling back, advocates such as the Defend Dissent Coalition argue that any new restrictions threaten freedoms and urge people to keep showing up and keep resisting the proposed laws.
In other news, environment groups have condemned the state government's decision to invite applications for two new petroleum exploration licences in Gippsland and the Otways. Environment Victoria and Friends of the Earth warn the move will fuel climate pollution, risk sensitive coastal and marine ecosystems, and undermine the state's emissions reduction targets.
Finally, in headlines, a recent report shows that the Victorian recorded its highest number of fatal drug overdoses in a decade last year. Heroin was the leading cause, while methamphetamine-related deaths have more than tripled since 2015, with men aged 35 to 54 most at risk. Experts say the increased deaths show the urgent need for rapid access to opioid treatments, drug checking, and early response systems in Victoria. Now, tune into Thursday Breakfast. I believe next week or the week after, we'll be doing dedicated coverage for Overdose Awareness Day on this topic, going through the report as well as speaking to some experts and lived experience people. And before we move on to the first segment, I often with headlines, we can, really rush through them and it's hard to give them so much airtime. It's such a small part of our show, and we dedicate so much of the rest of our show to dedicated segments. But I'm sure a lot of our listeners, as well as, you know, Leela and people on the show listening, the Al Jazeera journalist deaths have really affected me in a way, that we are also, doing a very small smidgen of what they have done. And I want to honour his words and they read out Anis's al-Sharif's last message. Mm-hmm. It was posted on Twitter. It's obviously in language and the translation can never live up to the meaning that is there, but I thought that would be a nice, important way to honour his memory, his daughter Shams, and as well as the other Al Jazeera journalists that were targeted. This is my will and my final message. If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. First, peace be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings. Allah knows I gave every effort and all my strength to be a support and a voice for my people. Ever since I opened my eyes to life in the alleys and streets of the Jabalia refugee camp, my hope was that Allah would extend my life so I could return with my family and loved ones to our original town of occupied Al-Majdil. But Allah's will came first, and His decree is final. I have lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times, and yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that Allah may bear witness against those who have stayed silent, those who accepted our killing, those who choked our breath, and whose hearts were unmoved by the scattered remains of our children and women, doing nothing to stop the massacre that our people have faced for more than a year and a half. I entrust you with Palestine, the jewel in the crown of the Muslim world, the heartbeat of every free person in this world. I entrust you with its people, with its wronged and innocent children who never had the time to dream or live in safety and peace. Their pure bodies were crushed under thousands of tons of Israeli bombs and missiles, torn apart and scattered across the walls. I urge you not to let chains silence you, nor borders restrain you. Be bridges towards the liberation of people and its land until the sun of dignity and freedom rises over our stolen homeland. I entrust you to take care of my family. I entrust you with my beloved daughter, Shem, the light of my eyes, whom I never got the chance to grow up as I had dreamed. I entrust you with my dear son, Salah, whom I had wished to support and accompany through life until he grew strong enough to carry my burden and continue the mission. I entrust you with my beloved mother, whose blessed prayers brought me to where I am, whose supplications were the fortress and whose light guided my path. I pray that Allah grants her strength and rewards her on my behalf with the best of rewards. I also entrust you with my lifelong companion, my beloved wife, Salah Bayan, from whom the war separated me for many long days and months. Yet she remained faithful to our bond, steadfast as the trunk of an olive tree that does not bend, patient, trusting in Allah and carrying the responsibility in my absence with all her strength and faith. I urge you to stand by them, to be their support after Allah Almighty. If I die, I die steadfast upon my principles. I testify before Allah that I am content with His decree, certain of meeting Him and assured of what is with Allah is better and everlasting. O Allah, accept me among the martyrs, forgive my past and future sins. I make my blood a light that illuminates the path of freedom for my people and my family. Forgive me if I have fallen short and pray for me with mercy, for I keep my promise and never change or betray it. Anas Jamal al-Sharif on the 6th of August 2025. And this is what our beloved Anas has requested to be published upon his martyrdom. And I hope everybody can sit with that and take it in and never forget about the brave work that these journalists have done. And none of us are doing enough, and we can all be doing more, but just really pay commemoration to every single brave journalist and Palestinian in the martyrdom when you have to fight like hell for the living. So thank you so much. And we'll be right back with the next few parts of our show.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is the 14th of August. It's currently 7:15, and we'll be playing the first segment of our show. My discussion with Shauna Moore, who's the head of policy, advocacy and government relations at Melbourne City Mission, who joined me yesterday to talk about the 2025 Victorian Youth Homelessness Snapshot, which was done in collaboration with Social Ventures Australia, which paints a really stark picture of the deep and intersectional challenges faced by young people experiencing homelessness in Victoria. And the 2024 data revealed that most young Victorians are losing their homes due to family violence. That's the majority. Many before the age of 16. Many are being cut off from school. Employment pathways instead are ending up in emergency departments. And the majority of young Australians who lose their homes were also known to the Victorian Child Protection System. So we will discuss the snapshot, the coalition, and where to from here. Thanks so much for joining us here today on 3CR Thursday Breakfast, Shauna. How are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I wanted to really focus on the 2025 Victorian Youth Homelessness Snapshot that you've done in partnership with Social Ventures Australia. I know it's the second annual report. Could you tell me why we really wanted to gather this data and present it in this way for the second year in a row?
Yeah, sure. So MCM, Melbourne City Mission, is Victoria's largest youth homelessness provider, and we operate the statewide youth homelessness access point, Front Yard, which you may have heard of, but also numerous refuges, foyers, youth homelessness programs. And, you know, we see time and time again this terrible journey of young people trapped in homelessness in Victoria. And we really have felt compelled to do this snapshot to really bring this data and to share our data of the experiences of, of these young people. And we will do this every year until we hope to see some change. And, you know, we see, I guess, from the front line, tens of thousands of children and young people every year who are turning up traumatised and alone to homelessness services like Melbourne City Mission, driven by family violence and a lack of safe housing options. Without a safe home, you know, they face serious risk of harm, including physical and sexual violence from others. And sadly, we know that a young person every 4 days in Australia is dying from homelessness. We also know that we've got very limited data and that a lot of the experiences, especially how they intersect, whether they're invisible or they're siloed. And we really wanted to, I guess, provide an evidence base to improve policy and investment, both from government, from philanthropy, but also the way the services are working together in Victoria as well.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's such an important point. And I think reading through the snapshot as well, it's interesting with like youth homelessness when sometimes they can feel so left out from the data, but then, you know, reading in the report that majority of these young people were known to child protection, have been, you know, experiencing pretty much all of them family violence and experiencing homelessness sometimes before the age of 16. So it's almost like they're known to the system and then also devoid of the data. And I'm wondering if you could, speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I think you touched on it. You know, it really is a siloed approach sometimes when it comes to data, and there's limitations in what national and state bodies can do to really decipher the data, and I know that there's some great work being done to link data sets, and that's kind of what we've tried to do in our snapshot. But this really does represent the core reality, as you said, faced by young people with nowhere to live, who are alone and invisible, and are literally trying to survive and stay alive. And these results tell a story of children and young people who are sitting in emergency departments instead of classrooms. And when I say they're sitting in emergency departments, they're not necessarily being admitted because they're homeless. But, you know, this is another issue that hopefully this snapshot data can shed light on. But they're not in classrooms, as the data shows. And many have experienced family violence at home and that loss of family and safety. But really alarmingly, and this is no surprise to any of the services on the front line, that the policy systems are entrenching young people in crisis instead of offering them a safe home. And they're trapped for many, many years until they become adults, or, you know, enter into the adult homelessness system where you're seeing that really chronic homelessness really visible on the streets.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, understanding that, yeah, young people are ending up in emergency rooms and it takes years to recover if you can, or you get, yeah, lead into more and more years of chronic homelessness. And I'm wondering, from the data and what you have heard about, you know, I'm seeing that homelessness for young people diminishes engagement in work. It's more contact with the emergency department for mental health concerns, you know, lack of, you know, culturally appropriate access. There's so much in that. And I'm when you think about the young people that you've interviewed, or the data that you've collected, what is kind of happening to young people who are experiencing homelessness?
Sure, yeah, and I guess this data does show the, you know, the experience and journey into crisis and homelessness. So there's some really great opportunities for intervention there, but also how the system is exacerbating the trauma and creating more trauma for them by keeping them stuck. So I think, you know, if I look at it at a high level, this snapshot shows four key things, none of which are a surprise to our staff. That firstly, young people are driven to homelessness due to family violence at home, like you mentioned. 4 out of 5 young people, that's 83%, and that's the tip of the iceberg, have experienced family violence. And of that, 67 were known to child protection. We know that, you know, a lot of young people are, you know, there's cases that are opened but then are closed, and that there's these kind of referral roundabouts as well in that slipping through the gaps with the child protection system. This data was also almost identical to the inaugural snapshot in 2024, which is not surprising. Secondly, there's mental health is, you know, a significant issue for young people in homelessness, from their trauma getting there and also from the experiences of homelessness itself. So we're seeing 1 in 2 young people seeking help from emergency departments to manage their mental health. It's kind of that missing middle and the issues there in terms of what's available to access in the mental health space. So the top of their list is often, you know, the emergency department, which is unacceptable. 2 in 3 have either attempted suicide and have thoughts of suicide or are self-harming. This is an increase from last year and is absolutely devastating. And this is a new data point we looked at, which was around chronic pain. We'd heard from a lot of the young people that we employ as lived experience advisors that there is a number of children and young people who are trapped in homelessness who are living in chronic pain. So that is kind of forever pain that sometimes means that they, you know, can't, they wake up and their legs aren't working, or their bodies are, you know, completely frozen and they're in a lot of pain, whether they're on the streets or in a refuge. It's really, really unacceptable that we've got, you know, homelessness really disabling young people as well.
Yeah, it's such it's okay. I was just going to comment on the fact that it's such a big issue that is also really close to my heart as well. And then knowing that, like, insecure or precarious housing can impact every aspect of your life. Like, think about every place that you need an address, you know, wanting to put an address in for work. And I'm wondering if you, yeah, could talk about the impact of what it means to, you know, be maybe without a residential address, or in moving from shelter to shelter, or yes, even like couch surfing. I think there's a lot of misconceptions around what homelessness entails, and I'm wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, well, I don't speak on behalf of somebody that's got an experience of homelessness, but what I hear from many young people who have survived homelessness is that, you know, this is hard work. It is survival every day of waking up, working out, where you're going to feed, where you're going to get your electricity, how you're going to stay warm or cold, you know, cool down, where you're going to sleep the night. So as the snapshot shows as well, that really diminishes a young person's engagement in study or work. And you hear a lot about young people being, you know, really feeling hopeless around their future because they're searching for the next place to stay or meal, that they're losing their school or they're losing their further education or ability to work. So that was the data that showed 2 in 3 young people are not engaged in study or work. And we also broke that down to look at school age students, and that was 3 in 5. So similar data to show that they're not in school. They're, you know, living in refuges in the streets and really spending all their time in appointments trying to navigate a system and trying to find where they're going to sleep that night, because, you know, we've got this system built that is quite short-term crisis, and you might spend a week in this refuge, you might get a few nights in a hotel here, you might have to go find a couch. It really is really exhausting, and it is exacerbating existing mental health issues, but it's also creating, you know, this housing anxiety, this real kind of anxiety for this generation, because if you're not safe at home, if you cannot live at home and with your family, you know that you're priced out of the private rental market and you're also excluded from the social housing system. So this needs to obviously, you know, be fixed urgently to ensure that we're not leaving our most vulnerable behind when we're talking about building a new, you know, social housing system, both federally and state. So that's kind of some of the things that are, you know, they're having to manage every day, but what they're losing, you know, is their future and their health. And we have seen too many young people who have passed away or died by suicide over the last 12 months since this last snapshot. And we're seeing that also in, you know, more national data coming from the federal government.
Yeah, it's truly heartbreaking numbers. And to hear that even in the 2 years of doing the snapshot, that these, you know, issues have long been there, but kind of emerging through the data. And when it comes to, yeah, where to from here, I know that there is a coalition, and from the snapshot, there has also been like advocacy, particularly mm-hmm. around intersectionality among young people experiencing homelessness, you know, people who are First Nations, LGBTIQA+, regional, remote, people who are born outside of Australia. I know these are key demographics that you've highlighted. I'm wondering, yeah, where to from here and how to be inclusive in this advocacy work.
Yeah, and it's probably, you know, very important to point out, and it is in our data, that 13% of the young people identified as First Nations young people, which is obviously an overrepresentation, and we think that is definitely underreported. 24% from the LGBTQA+ community, and 25% were born outside of Australia, which doesn't account for the young people, you know, who are from the Calm background. And as you mentioned, there is quite a lot of young people, 26%, who come from regional, rural and remote areas to access services, which again, you know, isolates them from their community and from their you know, any support networks they have in their school. So that is unacceptable as well, how we have this almost, you know, postcode lottery justice in terms of where you can access services having to come into the inner city or the metropolitan areas to access services. In terms of, you know, what we need to see, there's been a lot of advocacy done, and it's not in a vacuum. This snapshot is just one piece of, you know, advocacy or one reporting tool. There's a body of work. There is a humongous sector who have come together under the Hometime campaign, both in Victoria and across the country, over 170 organisations who are calling for 15,000 youth tenancies to be built into the housing system to ensure that the billions of dollars committed to social housing by the federal government through the recent election also benefits young Australians who are experiencing homelessness, because we must, you know, dismantle these long existing barriers that are discriminating against young people who are trying to access housing. So, you know, we need to build a dedicated youth housing response, which doesn't exist. And at the same time, we also need to a dedicated and statewide family violence, or I should say national family violence response for children and young people who are, you know, alone and unsafe. So those victim survivors in their own right who might be escaping violent you know, parents and mothers and who need a response as unaccompanied young people. So in terms of the Home Time Coalition you touched on just before, you know, we are... The Australian housing system at a federal and state level has really discriminatory barriers that impact young people and their ability to access all forms of housing, and that's purely based on their age. And that includes the lack of social housing targets for this group, which is coupled with that, you know, very low amount of income support payments in the form of youth allowance. So young people who are between the age of 15 to 24, kind of the cohort that we're looking at through Home Time, represent about 15% of the entire homelessness population across the country, but less than 3% in social housing system, because we do have a mainstream rental and housing market that doesn't differentiate between, you know, a child or young person and an adult, unlike the other systems like health or justice or legal or AOD that have set up individual separate systems to cater for a child and an adult, because it is very different. Instead, we have children, say a 16-year-old, competing with a 40-year-old for the same property but with less resources or earning capacity. So what the advocacy is doing is we are really advocating to have the 15,000 tenancies built in, the youth tenancies built into the housing system, and we're also advocating for increases to youth allowance so that housing providers, community housing providers, are not at a financial disadvantage when they're considering young people for their tenancies. Because of their lower income, they can collect, you know, they collect about half the amount of rent they can from an older person if they put them in the same house. So we're really trying to work as a coalition, both at a state and federal level, to try to address these youth housing penalties and really, I guess, unlock housing opportunities or fix the housing system for young people, because currently there is no housing system for them to be able to access. As I mentioned, they're priced out of the private rental market and they're excluded from the social housing system, which leaves them in homelessness until they're adults.
Yeah, thank you so much. Those are very, very important points there. I'm wondering if, yeah, there is some a young person who is listening to this who wants to get support for their housing, whether they are, you know, a young adult under 18 over 18. And if there is somebody in your life who is, yeah, experiencing housing insecurity, how can we support them, do you think?
That's a good question. And I think, you know, the Youth Homelessness Services and the Youth Services work extremely hard to support young people through a number of avenues, and are doing their very best, even in the context of the housing crisis. So reaching out in Victoria, we have Front Yard, we're a Melbourne City Mission, but every local area has a homelessness access point. Generally, you know, you've got local governments who have got information as well, but, you know, please, there's the phone line for Front Yard as well, you know, Melbourne City Mission statewide referral and intake or statewide referral line. So I think reaching out, it's really hard to, you know, reach out, understandably, but there are, you know, incredible youth homelessness organisations working really hard to find even that short-term accommodation and looking at, you know, education, looking at helping link back to school, or looking at, you know, those kind of mental health needs that we've identified.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. Such an important point to, yeah, just so many of our young people and people who are unhoused are some of the most, yeah, oppressed or forgotten about people in our society. So, yeah, just wanted to really bring attention to that and highlight that in this interview. But
yeah,
thank you so much.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for any of the young people that are safe at home, you know, and I was one of those people, you know, please, you know, go to the Home Time website and sign on to the campaign, because I think we really are engaging community and those voices are really imperative to get that change. We're seeing, you know, we are seeing a lot of interest from both state and federal government, and the more people that engage with the campaign and, you know, write to them, their MPs, and really call for this housing system to be fixed for young people, I think we will get there in the end. So, yeah, just a call to action for anyone that's feeling a little bit hopeless by seeing the data and seeing this snapshot. There is, you know, a huge coalition of organisations and unions and peak bodies and industry and experts and, you know, and the community who have come together. So there is this platform that everyone can participate in and share their voice.
Yeah, beautiful. We'll put the snapshot in our show notes as well. And that was Shauna Moore, who is the Head of Policy Advocacy and Government Relations at Melbourne City Mission, who joined me yesterday to discuss the 2025 Victorian Youth Homelessness Snapshot, which paints a really deep and intersecting challenges faced by young people experiencing homelessness in Victoria. Most young Victorians are losing their homes to family violence, many before the age of 16. Most of them have also been known to Victorian's child protection system. And experiencing chronic pain was another thing that they learnt. So lots of different populations are also overrepresented. And just as a retroactive disclaimer, it did touch on aspects of suicide. So if you do want someone to talk to you, you can call their suicide callback service on 1300 659 467. That's 1300 659 467. As well as Kids Helpline on 1800 551 800. And we'll put more information in the show notes, but if you are looking for services, there's also Ask Izzy, which is a great resource where you can find AOD, housing, food banks, lots of information like that, askizzy.org.au. And now I'll pass it over to Leela.
This is Thursday Breakfast. You're listening to 3CR 855 AM. On Monday, the 4th of August, Hank, a public housing tenant, locked himself to a drill, taking samples for demolition at Flemington Public Housing Estate. Hank successfully delayed work for over 2 hours and was supported by a community picket to save the 44 public housing towers scheduled for demolition by the Victorian government. Flemington residents have been told they must leave their homes by the end of September. Tenants and advocates are urgently calling on the Victorian government to halt demolition immediately, and you can find out more by going to linktree.com/savepublichousing. Good morning, Hank. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, we appreciate your time. I thought we could start with a bit of life context, a bit of personal context. Hank, what does living in public housing mean to you?
Well, as I'm looking out the window of my flat right now, I'm the 12th floor in Northcote, and I can see the whole horizon, and it's a very beautiful place, and it's a nice flat, and if it wasn't for these demolitions, fantastically secure, which is a great, I suppose, I hate to say it, it puts me in a privileged position in this terrible crisis where, you know, you've just been talking about young people being homeless, and this current threat makes us all very, very afraid of what's going to happen.
Mm. Yeah.
And on the personal note, I mean, talking to my neighbours too, yet last night, you know, there's secrecy, there's deception. So we don't know when, where, or how, what is going to happen to us.
Yeah, I can hear how much that security means to you, and I would assume so many people in public housing.
Yeah.
So my next question, straight to the point, if you are comfortable talking about it, Hank, why did you lock yourself to a drill last Monday?
Well, these people who are in Flemington, who are being, I mean, I was in the picket the week before, and you could see their furniture being moved out. Mm. They're in exactly the same position I and my fellow people, tenants in my own block, will be in soon. We don't know, like we said, we don't know what's going to happen to when it's going to happen, but we know what's going to happen. And there were assurances made that decommissioning wouldn't occur while there were people living in there.
Mm-hmm.
So So, I mean, this situation for them, I mean, you just mentioned that they've got till, well, theoretically, they've got till September that they've got to be moved out.
Yeah.
The people who are in there, well, this is just not acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to put that pressure on people, and we already know that the places that they're being moved to are not appropriate. I mean, there was a story given at last week's parliamentary inquiry of a woman who a Somalian woman from those block of flats who was like sent to Craigieburn all on her own, all away from her community that she's spent her life with, and her family has spent her, and her children spent their life with. You know, this is. And the flats people are being moved into, it's clear from all the reports that they're terrible. I mean, there's people paying $400 a month in electricity bills and they can't afford to even do their washing. They're going to their old block of flats and going in there to do their washing in there. I mean, it's absolutely shocking.
Yeah, it's just completely dehumanising.
Yeah.
Hank, you mentioned the hearings.
Yeah.
Have you been sitting in on those, and what's it like to actually witness people just like you, maybe people that you know, sharing their stories?
Well, I've only been to two of them,
mm-hmm.
and the second one was just organisations, I saw last week, which was like Rahu. I saw Rahu, HAG. Housing for the Aged, Rahu's the renters and housing union, and also 44 Flats United, giving Safe Public Housing Collective giving very good presentations on behalf of renters,
mm-hmm.
of residents, and the one before I saw some. Actual residents giving their stating what had happened to them, including some extremely good personal information, and it's good that the information's out there. Although I don't know, unfortunately, whether the parliamentary inquiry will have any actual impact directly on the decision that's being made, but it's good that the information's out there, and some of that information I just mentioned is from those.
Yeah. I mean, it's evidence that could build a case, but really what public housing tenants need is action now and to stop the demolition now.
Yes.
Have you spoken with other community members about their plans after you're forced to leave your homes and lives? Where are people going to go?
Well, I mean, that's where there's the great fear and insecurity, because... like I said at the beginning, there's secrecy and deception.
Mm.
I mean, it's clear that, I mean, that if people want a mental image, you know, you see a film and you've got somebody who's an evil character who's got these devil eyes, but the people we're dealing with have got dollar signs, but they're like the devil eyes, right?
And yeah, I've got the mental image.
So we know that that's what we're dealing with, and we know that these devils are not going to, are not concerned about our interests. So it's a lot of fear, and there's already the knowledge out there that where we're getting moved to is actually much worse accommodation, much smaller. People can't fit their furniture in there, and like I said before, it's more expensive.
Mm.
There's not the security of tenure that we have now. So that's why and the other thing is, like, what is the authority? I mean, they have the authority, the cabinet decision, they've got the power, but what's the legitimacy of that authority?
Yeah.
I mean, for example, they made the assurance not to do decommissioning work, but they did it anyway. So they're not only deceptive and secret, but they don't do what they say they're going to do, and that makes people very, very afraid. And that's why it was necessary, to take direct action, because the government is taking direct action.
Yeah.
And there isn't time for these people who are on the first flats. There's not time for them to for us to like be taking. I mean, it's there's all lots of different techniques that could be used, like demonstrations, doing rallies, organizing people. They're all very important, but it's come to the point where direct action is the only action that I see. And we're living in a time of mediated life through the internet. People are used to feeling that they're taking some power by, I don't know, putting their name on line through a appeals to the government to be nice. But but I don't feel like there's time for that. That's why I locked on.
Yeah, Hank, I have a lot of respect for your work, and I can hear how much you care and what motivated you. And I do think it's incredibly important to put a body in between these dehumanizing systems and to communicate, I guess, your real humanity. Like, every single person that lives in one of those homes in the towers has a body and a life and a community. And so I really respect you making that choice to actually insert your body in between those machines that are treating that land like it's a money-making... like a money-making project.
That's what they want to do. And, you know, it's that, like, the very old saying is, like, for every one person at a rally, there's at least 10 people that would be there but couldn't make it. And I think I'm just was in the position to be able to do it. A lot of other people who would want to can't, but if more people do it, it's going to be more helpful. But I'd like to actually connect it with the demands of that were put at the last parliamentary inquiry by Rahu at their submission.
Yeah, what are those demands?
They said that all evictions and demolitions should be halted. That's the first one now. Because there needs to be a truly, people need to be truly consulted. That's the second demand, before any further decisions are made, because no consultations properly are made. And like I said, we don't know what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and even doing a freedom information inquiry is not getting these facts out. Thirdly, is to build public housing proportional to the elimination of the waiting list. There's a housing crisis now, and at the moment there's 4,000, according to Rahu, there's 4,000 empty public housing flats that people who are living on the street could be in today, you know. So they should be dealing with the housing crisis and not be hard-hearted, stone-hearted people walking past as they go to Parliament in the city or go for their lunch, walking past homeless people knowing that they could actually be in a flat. And thirdly, it's to end means testing, so that it's not just this poor sector of the community, but everybody who needs housing can get access, including young people who are students or having to work in the gig economy or all these people who are at risk right now because of terrible landlords. And I would also add to that, that they mentioned, start building public housing, at least 15% across the board, to eliminate this waiting list and deal with homelessness properly, instead of it being all this private housing, which is called community housing.
Hank, thank you so much for that powerful message. We're going to have to wrap up now, but I really appreciate your insight and all the work you've done. Thank you so much for joining us on Thursday Breakfast.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for letting me have a say.
For us too. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855am. And in that interview, you heard the voice of Hank, a public housing tenant who locked himself to a drill last Sunday to delay works at Flemington Public Housing Estate. And now we're going to hear a segment from last Monday where Rob from 3CR's Monday Breakfast spoke with welfare rights activist Tom Students about the federal court case Chaplin v Secretary. The court ruled that the federal government will need to recalculate over $4 billion worth of debts issued using a method known as income apportionment. Here is Tom and Rob going over the history of income apportionment debt and its legislative overlaps with robo-debt.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. Well. Obviously, this ruling is super complicated. I just wanted to check that description of it was accurate.
Yeah, it's a bit of a pickle. If you've heard any of the politicians try and speak about this, they're not much help. But essentially, if you can comprehend what robo-debt was, that was basically taking a year of your income and slicing it up evenly across 26 fortnights of the year. This apportionment was basically to do that with a smaller time frame within days, meaning that if you had earned money in 1 week, it could be applied to the previous week. It was quite ropey. The department says that they stopped doing that around 2020, which is quite convenient as all debt raising was suspended during COVID. So they hadn't been doing any debt raising. And then the Robo-Debt Royal Commission happened, and during that process, the Department of Services Australia is what they're called now. Used to be Department of Human Services. They run Centrelink and Medicare. So they came clean to the Commonwealth Ombudsman during the Robo-Debt Royal Commission that they'd actually been unlawfully calculating debts a different way for even longer. It's just that they weren't doing that quite so deliberately in this case, although, what does it really matter to the person at the end of that debt letter? They just figured out that it was illegal before everyone else did in this case, and they said, we're not doing it. And then during the Robo-Debt Royal Commission, they were like, actually, we want people to know that we're not doing this anymore, and then we're going to recalculate these debts. And so it's important to say that a lot of robo-debts were partially calculated using this method, like apart from the fact they were robo-debts. These are debts that, as you said, extend into the 90s, and there's some evidence that they extend even further back. So we get to this Matthew Chaplin, who had a debt that was calculated by apportionment, and so he appealed that debt to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal at the time, now called the Administrative Review Tribunal, and they gave a pretty ropey decision. The Appeals Tribunal is the members that, as your listeners may be aware, that part of the reason the old tribunal was abolished was that it was stacked with Liberal Party apparatchiks, etc. But sufficient to say that tribunals often have people with varying legal qualifications on it. There's some people like me who don't have a law degree at all. And in this case, they came up with some pretty loopy stuff like, you count people's income at the time that they get paid, not when they work. That's when they become entitled to the income for the purpose of social security law. I'm pretty sure they just came up with that off the top of their head. they didn't seem to have tried to support that with employment law, or obviously that's been thought about. So that was one of the reasons it was appealed. And so it was like the department used a particular method to try and recalculate Mr. Chaplin's debt, which is what they were doing with these apportionment debts. So Centrelink, everyone accepts that those were illegal, right? This is about how they're recalculating it. And the contention here was that they were doing that in a way that was also illegal. But the federal court has accepted the department's formulation of the law, which is a very intriguing decision, which has some pros and cons, but effectively means that the department can go and just use that method to recalculate all these debts far back into the past as they want, really, which is not amazing. And that can be a legal way for them to sort out these many, many, you said it relates to $3 or $4 billion in public money, right? Like, so they think, hey, we've got a good method. We're going to go and grab these things now. Tanya Plibersek, the new social services minister, gave an interview last week where she sounded pretty set on that. And it was some stuff that she did back in the Gillard government that part of the reason we're in this mess. But basically, the federal court did something quite novel in that they actually decided the case with a tribunal case, and the dissenting opinion from Kenneth Jay, the 2-1 decision, sort of said, like, I don't know why you're doing that, because the act that regulates appeals to the federal court says that we shouldn't really be doing that. It should be confined to questions of law, not to actually decide cases, and then you meant to send it back to the tribunal. So that would avoid the situation where, like I said, basically the court has given the okay to read the Social Security Act in this way and go after these debts. It's arguable they didn't need to do that, but it's where we are now, and that's kind of a problem for everyone.
What does this ruling mean for people who are on welfare and, you know, and are obviously frustrated for that the government has been, you know, acknowledging that, you know, a few years ago that this method was unlawful and is only now, because of the federal court's ruling, have to change it, right?
Well, no, they accepted it was unlawful. This is just a way of them trying to still get at the money. That's the issue, is that there's still this concept, as in robo-debt, that, you know, you got to get the money off these people. You got to shake the welfare recipient population down. And like I said, a lot of these debts were also robo-debt. So they were calculated unlawfully twice. and where they've said that they are going to recalculate it, that obviously means correspondence with the department, people reliving old traumas, people having to go back and contact old employers. These are all features of robo-debt, and they're all things that were known to be very unfair about robo-debt. And the thing that people suspect will make that all go away is by implementing one of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission recommendations. It's actually quite a good recommendation. When the coalition government was implementing Robo-Debt, they passed a law that says Social Security recipients are exempt from the ordinary statute of limitations on debt recovery, right? So most states have similar like limits. It's about 6 years. In New South Wales, it's 6 years for any debt. After that, you can't get it, right? But welfare recipients have a different rule. The law is different for people who claim Centrelink because of robo-debt and also to make robo-debt happen. And so that was a very key recommendation of the Royal Commission, because that's the law that made it possible to go back and collect all these old debts, which is now what is being, like, relitigated, essentially. It's like Centrelink is saying, hey, we buggered up collecting these debts since the 80s. Could we have another crack, please? And the Federal Court of Australia has taken the position that, yes, you can. And I'm not so sure about that, because there are actually quite a lot of practical concerns.
Yeah. <about them. laughs> Yeah, I'm sure there's many. I mean, I feel like this rule is obviously, if, as you were saying, you know, the debts go all the way back to the 80s. I mean, it's going to take them a long time to figure out how much, you know, is actually owed or whatever. And
there's such discrete calculations, Rob. You're going in, you're going down, like, day-to-day people's employment histories from 40 years ago, possibly.
Wow.
30 years ago, 20 years ago. And that obviously disadvantages welfare recipients, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it means that it's, and this was talked about in the decision and in the dissent, and also in a number of lots of commentary about it. Not enough commentary, but basically, like, it just means that your position as a welfare recipient is, the less evidence you have, the weaker your case is. If they just pick a point in your past, you can pick a point in anyone's past and ask them to account for anything, and they'd have a lot of trouble doing it. So I don't think doing that hundreds of thousands of times, and what the department says is, the average variance in these debts is going to be like $300. But the cost administratively to go and do that is going to be astronomical. And I don't think it can actually be done by the current welfare system that we have in terms of staffing and capacity, in terms of IT system. There's so many problems with all of it. And it's important to note that the Department of Social Services, who have charge of the legislation in the welfare system, so that's why they were the respondent in this case. They put out quite a triumphant statement. It's like, yeah, we're going to go get the debts now. it's not that easy. It's actually very, very hard. And to the point where you shouldn't do it. Like, if those debts are varied down by $100, if we say they're $300 average, then the law says that debts under $200 should be waived by the secretary for the reason of they're not economical to pursue. It costs too much. To get a welfare debt, you have to pay a public servant a number of hours. You actually have to pay several of them working in several different teams to do that. So...
Yeah, so you can imagine that trying to recalculate those debts would be... You know, if they're averaging $300, it might not even be worth it, you know?
What's the point? And Tanya Plibersek said, like, the character of her remarks was like, well, but it's fairly owed to the government, and we have to get it because the law says we have to get it. It's like, there are more things to think about than that, aren't there? Like, the DSS is very triumphant. It's like the Robodebt Royal Commission... I thought we'd all sort of accepted that just saying, hey, this is technically legal, is not a very high bar for policy making or public administration. Like, just because a court can't stop it doesn't mean it's a good idea. It certainly doesn't mean it's worthy of Labor government to be doing this. It's such a completely undignified for everyone involved. That's what I mean. There's problems for everyone. When the fact that it's come to a court to make some quite interesting law about this is because the government doesn't know what to do. Like, I can't put it more simply than that, unfortunately.
Right.
They feel trapped by this political imperative, which drives everyone in this in this stuff, that welfare recipients have money for us. That money can go on the budget bottom line, and we can point at that and say, hooray, while obscuring all the spending that goes into recovering that money. Like, it's extremely Robodebt-like. It's the same sort of attitude. It's not that the scheme itself is similar. People are very sensitive to Robodebt comparisons, but I have some theories as to why. But, yeah, the Albanese government can barely explain any of this to a journalist, so...
Yeah,
they think tap out whatever the it's like. Oh, apportionment. Oh, that's really hard. We don't have. You wouldn't understand that.
You just heard a conversation between Rob from 3CR's Monday Breakfast Show speaking with welfare rights activist Tom Students. And Tom, in that conversation, unpacked the history of income debt apportionment calculations and its legislative overlaps with robo-debt. And you can hear the rest of this interview and more from Monday Breakfast by going to 3cr.org.au/Monday-breakfast.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Leela. And if you're just joining us, it's 8:05 in the morning. We've spoken about youth homelessness through Melbourne City Mission. We spoke to Hank, who's a public housing resident for Save Public Housing and Direct Action. And yeah, just heard about welfare rights and the replay from Monday Breakfast. And last up, we have an in-studio interview with Elijah McDonald and Rosie Kalila. Elijah McDonald is a Noongar Pinapina Yamaji Tech Artist Junior Programmer, and Rosie is a Wembawemba Gunjumara Art and Cultural Producer from Blacktasia, this continent's first ever Aboriginal mobile game, and they join us in the studio to talk about making of the game, art, inspiration, and the everyday work it takes to make a game by Mob4Mob. How are you both today?
Good, thank you for having us.
So I wanted to start off by saying, why was this game important to make for you?
So for us, we're all black fellas, we've all played games growing up, and there hasn't really been any games that have black fellas in it, and you know, all of our culture coming into like the game design especially. There's been a few things where there's been like one or two black characters, but nothing quite like this, where it highlights the kind of rich animals and landscapes and people in Australia.
Yeah, amazing. What kind of games were you playing growing up where you're like, I really want more of this in my life?
To be honest, a lot of games.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to put something exact to that, but yeah, just all the games that I played growing up, you know, like there was stuff like, you know, Sid Meier's Civilization. I remember playing like Tasmanian Tiger, which did have a lot of like motifs of Australian like culture in it, but it wasn't quite there, you know. So yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's really beautiful even looking on the Instagram. Like, all the art is so incredibly special and beautiful and really meticulous. So I was wondering what are kind of the components needed to make this happen, because having a game come off the ground is no easy feat with, like, a big team. So, yeah, how does a game get made?
Yeah, well, to start off with, there was a lot of pre-production, so planning around just the world and the core mechanics of it. So we had our lead game designer, Phoebe Watson. She spent a lot of time working on just figuring all of that out and trying to find a game design that felt right for us and felt good for Mob, who were, you know, we're making this game for. So at that point, at the start, there was a much smaller team, but as we've progressed through development, we've, you know, brought on a lot more people, more artists, more programmers, and yeah, so it's just really grown there, and yeah, bringing on people who have a lot of knowledge in different aspects of game development. So, you know, myself, I do some of the programming and technical art, you know, obviously Phoebe with the game design and writing as well. We also had like Patricia McKean. She's a Gunditjmara artist, so she's working on like concepts and that. We also have Charlotte Allingham, who's our creative director, so she was coming in with a lot of the creative direction, art direction, and also being the principal artist on the project, so she was pumping out a lot of the art as well. So yeah, just bringing in lots of different people, that was kind of the main thing there. Yeah,
beautiful. When you're thinking about like even just drawing, or is it like frame by frame, or are you animating like zooming out? I don't know how any of it works. Yeah. I'm just curious.
So it's all broken up into a lot of different programs. So there's this one we use, Blender. It's like a 3D like animation program. So we've got some people making the like the animals and the characters, and then you come in and like animate that sort of frame by frame, and then doing all the little in-betweens on that. But yeah, there's a lot of different programs, so the process is quite different across all of them.
Yeah, for like, sure.
I'm mostly in the game engine Unity, doing a bit of the programming and kind of bringing in all of the art that everyone's made into the game itself. So yeah,
beautiful. Yeah, I guess why did you choose this particular game design, and where did these inspirations come from?
Yeah, so with the game design, it was all about creating something that made sense to the First Nations audience. So in terms of the game design, it was all about creating these kind of a game design mechanics that really resonate with First Nations audience. So, because we've noticed, we did a lot of community playtesting. So throughout those, we kind of saw that the things that we were doing did line up with that. So a big part of the game is planting all the native plants, and those plants are specific to the levels, which are then inspired by specific parts of Australia as well. So, you know, we've had some of the older people, especially, that when they come in, they, even though it's not entirely necessary to do so, they tend to plant and design their space according to how their country is and all of the things that they know about it. And yeah, especially the kids as well, they really get into that.
Yeah, wonderful. I think there's so many beautiful characters to choose from. I was curious about what some of your favorite characters or areas in the games were.
You want to answer that one, Rosie?
I want to say the Land Defender Bush Mechanic girl. She is everything. Her outfit is just so cool. Like, I literally want to wear it myself. She's got these really cool, you know, chaps on, and there's like Aboriginal flag incorporated into the design as well on her kind of overalls. And she's just so like staunch and sweet at the same time. And that's what I love about her so much. The actual artwork done by Charlotte Allingham is, it's so joyous, but it's also staunch at the same time, and I love that so much. And that reflects what the game really is. And you know, when you're cleaning up country, she's always there just saying hey, you know. So I think that would be my favorite. I can't stop thinking about her at the moment. Yeah
beautiful, staunch and sweet. Love that. What about you, Elijah?
To be honest, I'd have to agree. Especially the belt that she's wearing. She's got a belt buckle on it that says Land Back. And really love that character as well. Yeah,
beautiful. And I guess when it comes to the behind the scenes every day for the team, I'm sure there's so many different moving parts. But yeah, I guess what does it feel like to be part of the first Aboriginal mobile game every day at work?
To be honest, I get so caught up in just working on it that I kind of forget.
Yeah.
And then when it is mentioned, it's feels a bit unreal, you know. But it makes me very happy to be a part of this project and working on it and working with all the mob on it. It's really special, yeah.
Yeah, I'd have to say coming in only last week, really, as new arts and culture producer for These Mob, it's like really incredible what you've all done. And so I think it is one of those things where you're like, you've been in it and developing it so much with all of the technical assets. And I'm coming in and I'm just like in awe every day. I'm like, wow, this is what you have been doing. So for me, it's a huge privilege and honour, and I feel incredibly proud to be stepping into this space and to see how the development has come along. And I'm so excited for, you know, what we can do next.
Yeah, beautiful. I am so in awe of like all your responses, and Alice's can't hear, but everybody's like smiling and cheesing over how special this is. And I can tell it's really close to both of your hearts as well. And so much love has been poured into this game. And I guess when we're taking it offline into the world, what has the Blacktasia launch been at the big games night out?
Yeah, so last year, yeah, we launched the Blacktasia original soundtrack at Big Games Night Out in Fed Square. sorry, excuse me.
It's okay.
It was unreal to see all of the people there. There was, you know, a good couple hundred, and we were putting on, you know, we're showing some of the songs that we've got for the OST for the first time to the public. And we also had like line dancing. So we got everyone involved in that. we showed everyone how to do it, and everyone was getting involved in that. And just seeing people's faces as well when they're listening to that. There's a lot of families there as well. And yeah, it just really made me smile to see everyone there and getting to share what we've been working on for so long with everyone, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. With the, like, the original soundtrack especially, like, what kind of vibe?
Yeah.
Or, like, what kind of, I guess, impact did you want to have on the audience with the music? Because that's such an important part of a video game. I feel like there's so much of the music of the games that I used to play is like the main things that stand out to me.
One of the biggest influences has kind of been like country music. So our composer, Robert K. Champion, he's from over in South Australia, been doing like country music for a few decades now, I think. But yeah, he came in with that kind of influence to the game, because he also has helped influence like the game design as well. He's associate game designer, so he works with like me and Phoebe on some of the mini games in it as well. But yeah, with the music and kind of the country and western theme of the game as well, he was a big influence on that, bringing that in. And so a lot of the music, he just came up with it, you know. Like each song kind of was just in the moment, some of it for him, and then we'd take that and then work with him in building that up into a full song.
Nice. How does the music or the animation just change when you're like defeating, is it the murk?
Yes,
defeating the murk, like cleaning up the bush, like, yeah, how does the different zones of the game come out?
Yeah, so the murk is this evil entity that's taken over the land and really corrupted everything. So you're fighting it back throughout the game, and each level is kind of unlocked by fighting back the Merc. And then after you've cleared it, you are then free to kind of go through and clean up everything and bring back life to the land by planting all the native plants. And as you progress, you're also then bringing back all the native animals as well. So in the first level, you're after you've beaten the Merc there, you bring back an echidna, and the echidna has its own little mini game. All the animals in the game, they have their own little mini games as well, and they're kind of designed around some kind of aspect of that animal.
Yeah, beautiful. What was there a recent mini game that was released? Was it a dingo recently?
Nah, but we've shown off the dingo that we've made for the game.
Oh, yeah. Yep, okay, yep. That's what I was thinking about.
Yeah. Nah, we haven't got anything out just yet, but yeah, we were showing off the dingo that we made because we went out to the dingo sanctuary in Victoria, and dingoes are, I think, a really important animal in Australia, especially in terms of like the ecosystem and kind of maintaining a balance there. So it was really important for us to bring that in and make sure that we have a dingo in the game somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And I know that we spoke a little bit about the launch at Fed Square. I can't believe having it in Fed Square and like doing line dancing is so wonderful. I can't imagine what that would have been like. But I'm wondering, yeah, what the reception to the game has been throughout development. I remember in one of your other interviews, Elijah, you talking about kids coming up to you and being like, I love this game.
Yeah. It is the sweetest thing ever. When we get to see especially the kids come and play it, because we've designed the game to be very kid focused. So like young mob is primarily who we made it for, but it's also all ages and everyone can play it. But yeah, just seeing them play it, it reassures us that we're doing everything right because of the very positive feedback we get. Because we've been doing, a lot of community playtesting, and then just this year going up to Yarwin Festival and Share the Spirit in Melbourne. Like some of the kids were very eager to keep playing, but yeah, they can't stay on the game forever, unfortunately, at least until it comes out.
Nice.
But yeah, it just makes me very happy, and I think the rest of the team shares that as well, yeah.
Amazing. And I know that it's such an incredible feat, and I was wondering if you both had any advice for, First Nations mob creative and game designers who are thinking about starting their own projects or like getting into something, game design.
Yeah, I would say just jump into anything really. If you've got access to a computer, you can really just do what you want and just start playing around and figuring things out. There's plenty of game jams online that you can join up with some friends or some people online and just start making games, really, and get connected with other mob like ourselves as well. You can shoot us a message on like our Instagram or whatever, or email, just get to know other people that are interested in working in that space as well.
For sure. And lastly, how can we play?
Yeah, so the game will be coming out around the end of the year or maybe January, so December, January, and it'll be for free on the Google Play and Apple stores. So, yeah, if you follow us on our Instagram, TikTok, whatever, we're blacktasia_game, that's our at. Just keep an eye out for when it comes out, and it'll be 100% free.
Amazing. Yeah, we could definitely put that in our show notes. For both of you, do you have anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up?
We are very excited that we will have a stall at PAX this year in October, so a few months away from the 10th to the 12th of October at Melbourne Convention Centre. So that will be a really cool opportunity for people to see, physically, the artwork and also the gameplay and get to see a little bit more before the game launches.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Rosie and Elijah, for coming on the show today. We'll have more information about Blacktasia. Stay tuned for the end of the show.
Hi, everyone. My name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive, It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website, 3cr.org.au, or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
You're listening to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. We're coming up to the end of our show. It's the 14th of August. It is 8:25. And you've just heard from Black Tasia staff, Elijah McDonald, who is a Noongar Pila Pila Yamatichi, tech artist, junior programmer, and Rosie Kalina, who is a Wemba Wemba Gunajumara art and cultural producer at Black Tasia, the continent's first ever Aboriginal mobile game. And first up, what we had in the show was Shauna Moore, the head of policy, advocacy and government relations at Melbourne City Mission, who joined me yesterday to discuss the 2025 Victorian Youth Homelessness Snapshot, which paints a really stark picture of the deep and intersecting challenges faced by young people experiencing homelessness in Victoria. Many young people, a majority of them actually losing their homes due to family violence before the age of 16, and have lost their homes while still being, you know, known to child protection, experiencing kind of pain, and different demographics overrepresented. And yeah, just so much more to do in this space. And speaking of housing, we then spoke to Hank, who on Monday the 4th of August, Hank was a public housing resident that locked himself to a drill, taking samples for demolition at the Flemington Public Housing Estate. Hank successfully delayed works for over 2 hours and was supported by a community picket to save 44 housing towers scheduled for demolition. And you can learn how to get involved in one of the most local important fights by visiting Linktree // save public housing, or one word. And we'll also put more information about that in our show notes.
And after that, we heard a segment from last Monday where Rob from 3CR's Monday Breakfast spoke with welfare rights activist Tom Students about the federal court case Chaplin v Secretary. The court ruled that the federal government will need to recalculate over $4 billion worth of debts issued using a method known as income apportionment, which was in use from the early 90s until 2020. In that conversation, Tom Students unpacked the history of income apportionment debt calculations and its legislative overlaps with robo-debt. You can hear the whole interview and more from Monday Breakfast by going to 3cr.org.au/Monday Breakfast.
And lastly, we heard from Elijah McDonald and Rosie Kalina from Black Tasia, the continent's first ever Aboriginal mobile game. And they spoke about what it takes to make a game, art inspiration, reception from people they've play tested, line dancing at Federation Square. A game by mob for mob where you store the bush, have mini games with beautiful animals and defeat the corrupting force of the Merc. And just before we go, we've spoken about this in the last few episodes, about the Footscray Safety Forum. It's about exploring safer and supportive responses for community. And that is today at 6 p.m, Thursday the August 14th at 6 p.m. At St. John's, which is 38 Pickett Street, Footscray.
Yes.
And there will be there's chairs, there is community lawyers, people from South Sudan Child's First Education, former Maribyrnong councillor Jorge Herrera and Greg Dunham, as well as 3CR amazing person Spike Chapalone, who
yes is previous Thursday Breakfast alumni.
alumni. And they're always an incredible voice. I'm so glad. So, yeah, if you can come down on Footscray.
That is a child-friendly event, and there is two steps into the venue just for your access needs, just so you know.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And, I just want to, again, reiterate how amazing the work of a lot of the Al Jazeera Gaza journalists have been, to not ever forget their martyrdom, their incredible work, and to keep fighting for it. And if you want to read Anas al-Sharif's message, his final message, it is on their Twitter, which will also link as well. But yeah, Lila, did you have anything you
wanted
to add?
Yeah, and just finally, if you want to continue supporting people in Gaza, you can donate to Gaza Mutual Aid at PayPal is at Yasmeen TM. That is at YASMEENTM. So we encourage you to do so. And yeah, just extend a little bit of support to people who are really, really suffering under Israeli genocidal tactics.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it can just be so easy to feel hopeless or there's so much going on, but many hands make light work and a regular mutual aid practice can really be life-changing. A lot of us don't think twice about doing things, but yeah, that's all we have time for today. Hope you have a good day.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.